This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the Black is Back Coalition held a national conference at Howard University in Washington. The theme was Black Power Matters, and the demand was Black community control of the police. And Bruce Dixon has some choice words for a new generation of Black activists.
But first, a bipartisan coalition of Republicans and Democrats is backing a bill that would shorten some mandatory minimum prison sentences. The Sentencing Project, a Washington-based prison reform organization, held a teleconference. Glenn Ford attended the teleconference. He challenged the idea that President Obama has been an ally of prison reform.
The Obama administration's widely given credit for playing a leading role in reversing the disparate treatment for crack cocaine offenders. But isn't it true that in 2013, the Obama Justice Department successfully argued, and the case was the U.S. versus Blewett, to keep thousands of people who'd been convicted under the old law in prison, resulting in thousands of them being kept behind bars for additional years. And that's essentially the same group that was recently released or eligible for release to much fanfare just last month.
Jeremy, would you like to take that on?
Sure. I'm trained as a lawyer. I'm not practicing. I know a little bit about that case. And as I understand it, the Justice Department made a legal determination that in that case, retroactivity should not apply. I personally do not see that as representative of the administration's views. That was a decision made by, you know, lawyers studying constitutional law and applying that in this specific case. On the contrary, you know, the president has and other officials in the administration have repeatedly supported legislation that would apply the Fair Sentencing Act retroactively, beginning with the Smarter Sentencing Act and now with this legislation. So we feel like the president and the administration have strongly supported reduced penalties for those individuals.
So the U.S. Justice Department goes into the federal court system and successfully argues against retroactivity, but you think that that does not indicate the administration's actual position?
As I understand it, there's a difference between a policy position and applying the law as it's interpreted. And so, as I said earlier, the president and the administration, former Attorney General Holder, current Attorney General Loretta Lynch, Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates, have all strongly supported making the Fair Sentencing Act, applying it retroactively.
It could also be interpreted as saying one thing in public and doing something else, actually, in court.
You certainly could make that interpretation. Of course, administrations are fraught with lots of different kinds of actors. I would say this. I think top management at the White House is very completely committed to this piece of legislation, including retroactivity provisions. So whatever sins there may have been in the past, I think they're definitely committed to that at this stage. I mean, I've been told that by people at the very top of the administration, the White House.
That was the voice of political consultant Bob Kramer. Sentencing Project Executive Director Mark Maurer said much needs to be done to reintegrate former prison inmates back into society.
We have a very substantial problem of reentry from prison. It has become, you know, well known certainly over the last 15 years or so. There's been significant attention recently to the 6,000 people who've received a sentence reduction under the change in the guidelines for drug offenses. And, you know, many people have wondered, you know, what's being done for these 6,000. We generally urge people to try to look at the larger picture, which in many ways is much more sobering, and that is that every year 600,000 people are released from state or federal prison coming home. So while this recent release was a chunk for 1 week, and in the grand scheme of things, it's a relative drop in the bucket. The good news here is that there's more concern, more attention, more resources being put into reentry at the federal level and the state level. In recent years, through the Second Chance Act in Congress and some similar provision in many states. But the bad news is the scale of resources going into reentry services is still a relative drop in the bucket, given the vast needs that people have coming home. So we hope that this legislation and ongoing movements can call further attention to the fact that we need to be looking at both what kind of programming goes on inside prison to prepare people for release, and then what that transitional services and support look like when they're back in the community.
Also in Washington, the Black Is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations gathered at Howard University for a national conference under the theme Black Power Matters. Black Is Back Coalition Chairman Omali Yeshitela said Russia did the right thing by helping Syria defend itself from U.S.-backed jihadists.
And all the white people in the world outside of Russia act like that's the most insane, crazy, irrational thing they ever heard of. It blows my mind. Here you have the United States government that's given billions and billions of dollars to a white bandit entity that's called Israel, where it stole the land of the Palestinians, set up a whole white nationalist settler state, claiming as their own, but that's all right. The United States can give it all kinds of resources, etc. The United States give resources to bandit governments and entities all around the world, but somehow Russia can't support an ally that's fighting what the United States claims is terrorism. Doesn't explain why the United States has been supporting these terrorists all this time and funded them and funded ISIS and funded every criminal with a gun and a bomb in the Middle East was funded by the United States. Even the modern jihad that people are talking about they're so upset about was created by the Carter regime and Brzezinski and the rest of that. So all of this upset that they've got, you know, it portends like real serious contradictions. And black people have to be aware of this. We have to be aware of what's happening. Did you know when the French fought in Vietnam to try to maintain Vietnamese colonialism, when they had to fight the Vietnamese, did you know that 71% of the people who fought in the French army against Vietnam were colonial subjects from Algeria, from Senegal, from all these other black places? And I read during the 1960s that 65% of the people on the front lines fighting against the people in Vietnam were black people from this country. Now, I'm telling you that what these guys are doing, they have serious implications for African people, so it's not something that we can ignore. And so this is why it's really important for us to have this discussion that we're having now, because we don't just live in Washington, D.C., in Chocolate City or chocolate anything, because you notice that what you call chocolate today, you know, tomorrow can be vanilla, if they want it to be. So we have to understand what's happening in the world, and we have to understand where we fit in the context of a changing world that's got white power around the world trembling because they don't know exactly how to deal with it, because the traditional imperialist forces are having to fight to hold on to their world domination. And it doesn't mean that everybody they're fighting against is a friend of ours, but it does mean that imperialism cannot function in the same old way that it used to function in, and that we have a responsibility to understand where we as a people fit in this process to organize, to build a revolutionary movement so that we can take advantage of the crisis of imperialism and win our freedom. I was there in August. In August, the Russians were responsible for, I say the Russians, formerly, is done by a group called the Anti-Globalization Movement of Russia. But there's no doubt about it that they are close to the Kremlin. They couldn't make stuff happen the way they do without being close to the Kremlin. So they sponsored this conference. It was a dialogue of nations and the struggle for self-determination. And invited there were Irish people, because as quietly as it's kept, there's people who are still in struggle with England, who kept Ireland under colonial domination for 800 years. The Irish were colonized for 800 years by the English. There were people there from Puerto Rico who were fighting for liberation. There were representatives from Hawaii, where the queen was overthrown. And the queen looked just like Sister Margaret here, right? Was overthrown in 1893. Overthrown by some white people just went there. Do you understand? It's a group of white people just went to this place called Hawaii, said, we want this. These are business, white business guys. Overthrew the queen and took it over. And now it's now a part of what they call the United States of America. So there were representatives there, from there. There were representatives from Spain, from Catalonia in Spain, who have created a massive movement. You're about to see Spain fracture, because the majority of the people in what they call Catalonia want to be independent from Spain. So they were there. There were representatives from the Polisario Front who are engaged in struggle in the Western Sahara, where Spain had dominated them. And once Spain retreated, now Morocco has come in to keep the people from being independent. And these were some of the folk who were represented at that conference. There were people from Ukraine who are even at this moment are engaged in armed struggle against this puppet regime that's been put in place again by the United States. So the discussion was a dialogue of nations, and everybody was there. This ain't like the United Nations where just anybody is there. Everybody who participated in this conference was trying to find a way to be self-determining. And I was there speaking for Africa and African people in that conference. That's what my role was with all of these forces there. And among the things that I put forward at the conference, and it was really interesting because nobody even challenged me on my right or authority or anything like that, because they know ain't no authority in Africa speaking for Africa or any other place. So we are the authority, and we are speaking for black people in this country too, and they're interested in what's happening to African people in this country because they see this incipient movement and they see the police murders and things like that. And I want to give them interpretation for it. Because if I don't give them interpretation for it, some white liberal or some other force will define this reality for us. So we put forth a working group. And out of this working group, we put the various kinds of demands that will become a document that's presented to the United Nations. And that we are going to get support from the Russians and from other forces because they got their own beef with the United States. So I don't know how much they like me. They act like they like me a lot. But the fact is, I know they got a beef with the United States. And I know that's the reason I'm there, because they got a beef with the United States. Well, I got a beef, too, with the United States. We got a beef, too, with the United States. I don't require them to like me or to love me. What I require of them is to show solidarity with the beef that I got so I can show solidarity with the beef that they got, with the enemy that both of us are able to recognize at this given moment. So I put forth for African people, first of all, the recognition that black people are African people and we've been forcibly dispersed against our will. The only reason that we fight in a battle in Ferguson is because the Portuguese, 600 years ago of July of this year, went into Africa and began kidnapping and stealing black people and dispersing us against our will. Secondly, that we're glad that y'all like us and sympathize with us, but what we really want you to unite with is the demand for black self-determination, that Africans want self-determination. We don't need sympathy. We're glad you like us, etc., and you oppose what the United States is doing, but support our demand for self-determination. We want to be a free people, independent of the authority of the United States government. That was another thing that I put forward to them. I put forward that they should support the demand for reparations to African people. That should be a part of the declaration. In addition to supporting demand for reparations, I said that we want the world to recognize the right of African people in the United States to exercise armed self-defense against colonialism and colonial terror. We want the whole world to recognize the right for African people to exercise armed self-defense. And we also asked them to support our demand to take the United States before the United Nations on the charge of genocide being committed against African people. These are some of the demands that we asked them. We also asked them to recognize the right to return. Any African, any place in the world want to go home, has a right to be able to do that, and that no authority on earth should be able to prevent us from doing that. That ain't going to make it happen, But what we do is put it on the agenda. We open, broaden the agenda, take African people out of this domestic thing that's been put on us, that somehow the white country or the white people own African people. We are our own people. We have our own list of demands. And we recognize who our enemy is. And so that's the thing that we put. We want the world to recognize that. We want the world to say, yes, reparations for African people. Oh, and we also demanded freedom of all African political prisoners. We asked them to recognize the right for freedom of all political prisoners. And then we said, all the black people in prison in this country, we want you to recognize that they should be free. This is the demand that we took to them that's supposed to be cobbled into this general declaration, and one that we want everybody in the world to be able to recognize. Because once we break out of this box of encirclement, United States has encircled us and isolated us from the rest of the world. The imperialists have isolated us from the rest of the world. And I think that part of the process of breaking out of that encirclement was what happened there. And if you will see, it's an extraordinary thing to see, to hear Russians quoting Malcolm X and talking about Marcus Garvey and Dr. Martin Luther King and black is black and black community control of the police. That's what's happening in Moscow today as a consequence of our being able to take the struggle out of this confine that the United States government and the white people who love us would have us locked into.
Omali Yeshitela of the Black is Back Coalition.
Black Agenda Report senior columnist Margaret Kimberly also addressed the Black is Back conference. Kimberly says black people need to build a political movement with a global perspective.
A couple of days ago, someone recorded that the 1,000th person in this country was killed by police on November 2nd. 1,000 people killed, and the year's not even over yet. That means on average 3 people every day, 1 every 7 hours. On the other hand, 32 police have been killed in the line of duty this year. That's once every 228 hours. But anyway, so I just wanted to point that out and want to thank the Malcolm X grassroots movement because they were the first who talked about actually getting the data on police murder in this country. Americans love to talk about living in a democracy, but that's just one of the ways in which the nation is so hypocritical. The suffering around the world that has all been created by this country. The United States killed between 500,000 and 1 million people in Iraq. The rulers, having gone through that, what turned out to be a political debacle, they decided they wanted someone a little less obviously bloodthirsty than Bush. So they chose a president who said he wasn't against all wars, just dumb wars. And to Barack Obama, that meant not sending American troops abroad. So Libya was destroyed and its president assassinated by the United States, the rest of NATO, Saudi Arabia, and other Gulf monarchies, by the jihadists who the U.S. and NATO funded. But of course, those jihadists that they've done for the last 40 years do what they want. So some of them killed the U.S. ambassador in Benghazi. So Republicans pretend they want to make hay out of Hillary Clinton, who said, we came, we saw, he died, about Gaddafi. Yeah, yeah. And she deserves to be condemned for her crime, but they're all guilty. Yeah. So in 2011, after Libya was destroyed, Gaddafi was killed, flush with this seemingly easy victory, the United States decided to move on to Syria. But fortunately, the Syrians were able to hang on. Yeah. And that's important. And it doesn't matter what anybody thinks about Assad. That is his country. That is a legitimate, the sovereign government of that land. And no one had the right to say Assad must go. But the crimes there resulted in the deaths of 250,000 people, the displacement of 9 million more. And because some of these people are now seeking refuge in Europe, there's suddenly attention paid to the refugee crisis created by the U.S. There are refugees all over the world created by American aggression in Somalia, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Pakistan. And the New York Times has started this whole video thing this week about children who were refugees without ever mentioning that their misery is caused by the U.S. But things have changed in Syria. The Assad government, resilient but still weak. So finally, after going back and forth and who knows what decisions Putin had to make, finally, the Russians drew a line in the sand. But I don't know about the rest of you, but the sight of Barack Obama and Putin meeting at the UN was very entertaining to me. I think you saw the photos of Obama not wanting to shake Putin's hand and looking petulant and offended. But it was all because someone else in the world said no more. and was able to back up those words, that everything changed. So now it's Putin calling the shots in Syria. It's Putin who proved beyond any doubt that the United States was lying about wanting to get rid of ISIS. ISIS was fighting Assad, so the United States hoped ISIS would get rid of Assad. But Putin just went in and started bombing ISIS and proved that the U.S. was lying. But while it was good to see that, it's still a very dangerous situation. The U.S. is now sending, they keep trying to back these moderates, spending $500 million to send 50 people over there or something crazy, but now they're sending F-15s. So far there's an agreement the Russians and the Americans will tell each other when their planes are in the air, but I don't expect that to last. And just as an aside, I used to imagine, I said, suppose there was a black president, and finally he was the one who started World War III. So I hope my imagination wasn't too prescient. But anyway, but the U.S. is unpredictable and still very aggressive. So I want to move into this situation that involves the whole world, everybody on the planet. And we talk about black power mattering, but if we don't speak against imperialism, then we're not talking about the whole picture. We have to speak against war and capitalism and everything else that makes the world a misery for many people. We have to acknowledge, and talking about the Black Lives Matter organization, not necessarily the movement of the millions of people who want to speak against the police murder, but they remind me of people who've always been around. I call them professional black people. And I don't mean black people in various professions, but people who make a living off the conditions the rest of us live in. Yeah. Some of them are crooks like Al Sharpton. Yeah. Some of them are the misleaders. Yeah. Some are the politicians and corporate-backed organizations that are elevated as leadership, but they don't achieve much for the rest of us. So there's a long history of people like this group. So let's be clear. No one would have heard of them if George Zimmerman hadn't been acquitted of killing Trayvon Martin. And I'm not saying that injustice should not have sparked activism. Of course, it should have. But we need to watch the Black Lives Matter and the Campaign Zeros for their lack of political activism and ask what they're doing for people who've made their name a household word. We've seen this before in the 60s. People in Newark and Watson, Detroit rose up. And our system, which is resilient and clever, responded, but not in a way which helped the people who mobilized. Those in the vanguard were crushed by COINTELPRO and political imprisonment. Some were given jobs, some were given elective office. But the people who cried out in outrage got nothing but redlining or imprisonment. Yeah. So we know now the names Eric Garner and Freddie Gray and Michael Brown, but we know their families didn't get justice either. Now, it's interesting to me that with all these, as Glenn said, they don't even know what a demand is, but I think there's some cynicism going on there. They don't make simple demands to meet with Hillary Clinton, who's running for president, and not ask her, are you going to prosecute killer cops?
Yeah.
So, you know, Campaign Zero talks about, they keep saying there's this high standard of proof for federal prosecution of police, and that's a lie. Obama can prosecute anybody he wants to prosecute. Mm-hmm. He claimed the right to assassinate American citizens and killed Anwar Awlaki and his son. So if he wanted Darren Wilson to be in jail, he'd be in jail. Yes. And there are previous precedents under George H.W. Bush, who prosecuted the cops who beat Rodney King, lest we forget. So we have Obama, and we had the Holder, and now Attorney General Lynch. But nothing has been done, and these new leaders can't seem to even speak that simple fact. So this is a cynical perfection of what they have done. And these omissions are clear, give us a clear guide of what their motives are. But now, because they're very savvy, people think they're really activists acting on all our behalf. So everywhere you go, every meeting, every conference, is Black Lives Matter going to be there? As if their absence mean that it's not a legitimate gathering. So they've hoodwinked a lot of people who clearly ought to know better. So what have they left us with? Now we all on social media, every time you go on Facebook, every time you go on Twitter, look at this video of the girl thrown to the ground by the cop in the high school. People beaten for jaywalking in Austin, Texas the other night. A man killed by university rent-a-cops in Cincinnati. But we all know, we all get it. But what do they say we ought to do, aside from showing us these images? But I would say at this point, we'd know who's a real agent for change and who's just an opportunist. DeRay McKesson claims that there's some connection between the Panthers and charter schools. He's clearly not as smart as the people in Black Lives Matter because he just says stupid stuff, which shows people where he's really coming from. But again, the people of Ferguson and Baltimore, what did they get? And where did Black Lives Matter stand on other issues, on imperialism, on gentrification, on the stop and frisks and the jump outs? What do they say about mass incarceration? Imprisonment starts with police encounters. These issues are all linked. How do they feel about black power? Do they assert it at all? Are they willing to make the right friends and the right enemies? So I think we can judge them. They may not be conversant on what happens in Syria, but they're smart enough to say something if they want to. So they should speak about injustice all over the world. And as O'Malley said, we can talk about subjects all over the world. Let's not forget Dr. King, a year to the day before he died, came out against the Vietnam War. And everybody was angry with him, the SCLC, his own father. Everybody said, you just stay over here in civil rights. You can't talk about the rest of the world. But it's our obligation to talk about the rest of the world and to make every issue a litmus test. Because as I said before, I think everyone's survival hangs in the balance.
That was Black Agenda Report senior columnist Margaret Kimberly. Bar executive editor Glenn Ford is a founding member of the Black is Back Coalition. He talked about the critical importance of making demands of power, like the coalition's demand for black community control of the police.
It's a demand that calls for the dismantling of the occupation army that the Black Panther Party identified and described back in 1966. We demand black community control of the police as a principle of self-determination, not just for the amelioration of the excesses of the policing system as it now exists. We do not make this demand in order to put body cameras on police or to get more black police or any of that other nonsense. We demand that the occupation be removed so that we can get on with the business of achieving self-determination, that struggle that was interrupted back in the 60s. And that means getting on with the task of building black power. And that, of course, is why the theme of this conference is Black Power Matters. And the demand of this coalition is black community control of police. It's because those two are inextricable. They are inseparable. To be frank, there's been a great deal of atrophy, which is another way to say rot, in black politics, and especially in left liberationist politics in black America over the last two generations, that is, since our last great grassroots movement was crushed. Many of our politically active people do not know what the word demands means. They do not know the meaning of the words. I'm not saying they shun demands and they don't like demands. They don't know what the hell a demand is. And that is really very serious. That's scary. That is what scares me about the state of development of our movement. They have been led to believe that anything that comes out of their mouth amounts to a demand. For example, they demand respect from Hillary Clinton. Now, what the hell is that? And how do you know when you got that respect? And what you gonna do with that respect when you think you got it? That this is worthless. They demand that Hillary and the rest of the presidential candidates be sensitive to black people. Same damn thing. How are you gonna measure just how sensitive they are? And what good is it? And why do you even care what they think about black people? So this is the kind of nonsense that passes for political analysis, commentary, and they demand that the Democrats give them a debate or a town hall, but they don't have any actual demands to put forward when they get to that debate or that town hall. All they say that they're going to do when they get there is ask questions. So the answers must lie with the Democratic presidential candidates. So we await the picture of what our struggle is going to look like after this town hall, when they will tell us what it looks like. Movements, of course, are defined by their demands. That is elementary. That is fundamental. And to that extent, the extent that movements are defined by their demands, the two factions that go under the heading of Black Lives Matter Network and Campaign Zero have dropped out of the movement, and they have dropped or jumped or leaped into the Democratic Party. And if that's all the problem was, bid them adieu. Tell them to have a good time at the next Congressional Black Caucus weekend or something like that. But it is a much bigger problem than these two factions. In our work, we need to remain clear in our own understanding of the nature of demands. But we also have to give clarity to those that we work with outside of our organizations. We have to give them clarity about what the nature of demands is, because there is a widespread void in terms of the fundamentals of movement work. Our demand for Black community control of the police is meant as a revolutionary demand. And it's revolutionary because it requires that the state give up at least some of its claim of sovereignty over Black people as Black people. It requires, therefore, a transformation of the power relations between Black people and the state, at least in those areas where we live. This we understand, and that makes it a revolutionary demand. Now, I think all of us know that, in fact, we will have to seize the power, of community control of whatever security forces we deem necessary. Or we will have to make a credible threat to seize that power. But none of that will happen if we do not make the demand. It begins with the demand. So the question then becomes, who are you making the demand to? The oppressor is not going to give up his sovereignty over us because we demand it. Of course he's not. He'll write that down, but he's not going to give it up just because we say so. But here is the important point. Revolutionary demands are not primarily meant for the oppressor's ears at all. We're not saying it for him. These are the words we speak to our own people. They're meant to give, what I was talking about earlier, voice and clarity and logic to the aspirations of the people themselves. Black people have already said, and they've said so at hundreds of demonstrations in just the past year, that they want killer cops out of the community. And when they say that, they're not talking about one or two or three killer cops and y'all can let the rest stay. They are talking about the institution itself. This is a mass and popular demand, and the people who are putting forward that demand, I'm not talking about the people in this room, but the people out there, the people who are putting forward that demand are not talking about one or two cops, they're talking about the institution. At root, they are talking about Black community control of the police. We didn't make this up. We just have ears, and we are them. Our job is to keep that demand, which is already popular, which comes from the people, our job is to keep it out there front and center. And that dictates much of what we are asking each other, all our constituent organizations, to do. Demands. The abolition of prisons. That is another revolutionary demand. because, again, that will not happen without eliminating the system in which rich white people rule over black and poor people, who must therefore be disciplined into accepting that rule through incarceration. So it's a revolutionary demand. But there are reformist demands, and we need to examine them. Genuine reformist demands are the kinds of demands that do not require a revolution to achieve, but would significantly improve the conditions under which the people live. It would improve their freedom to struggle, and it would improve or increase their overall power to determine their own destinies without actually overthrowing the system. Here's an example that I would give you of a genuinely reformist demand, one that I think the Black Is Back Coalition could probably get behind. I'm not putting it forward, but just as an example. We could demand that the federal government bring the number of black people held in federal prisons to the same level as white prisoners held on drug charges, and that they do this within a set amount of time. And it's not an unreasonable demand on the federal government, because federal prosecutors actually control the process of the intake and outgo of federal prisons. That can be accomplished without the rulers giving up power, but it would weaken them if they accepted it, and it would free a lot of black people. So it's a genuine reformist demand. Then we have those proposals that are put forward and called reforms, but do not substantially increase the people's power or improve their lives in any decisive way. But they do give a false impression of progress. These kinds of proposals are often put forward not by the people, not by the reformers. They are put forward, in fact, by the rulers themselves. And these kinds of reforms include body cameras and sensitivity training for the cops, all of which comes straight out of the Obama administration's COPS program and the task force on policing in the 21st century. Many of these kinds of items are found among the so-called demands of Campaign Zero. That's DeRay McKesson and his crowd. If you go through there, you'll find all kinds, a gumbo of best practices of the Cleveland police, best practices of the Seattle police, just a real hodgepodge, most of which is derived from the police or the U.S. government bureaucracy itself, and then funneled or recycled as a demand by Campaign Zero. What those proposals really are pre-approved ideas that the rulers have already decided will not slow them down one bit and may make it easier to contain and control black people. They have thought long and hard over these proposals and decided which ones they are going to market and ask the people who work closely with them to treat as if they are demands. So once we get beyond revolutionary demands, like our demand for black community control of the police, we have to approach reform with an eye on whether they increase the power and the momentum of the struggle or serve to confuse or slow or divert that movement. In general, that's how we should look at these proposals that call themselves reforms. Sometimes the questions are very complex, so I'm not trying to act as if this is a simple process. It's anything but simple, because you're coming into the middle of what may be somebody else's conversation and you don't know where it's going. For example, even though our demand for black community control of the police is a revolutionary demand, we sometimes will have to pursue the goal by reformist means. And for that reason, the coalition has put together a black community control of police kit, And that kit contains a model resolution for community control. It's a model that can be brought before a city council or a county council. It also includes a petition that demands black community control of the cops. And there's a card that helps people know their rights when they get confronted by police. We do not believe that black folks will win black community control of the police by signing petitions or sending resolutions before city councils. But our job, as we said, is to give voice and clarity to what is already a popular demand, which is a revolutionary demand. And I'm just going to say one more thing, and I promise to the lady with the one-minute sign that I will be through. In much of black America, our communities are being dispersed. We all know that, especially in this city, dispersed by gentrification. So, and this impacts directly on black community control of the police. What community are we talking about? When we talk about black community control of the police, we are dealing often with shrinking black communities, numerically and geographically. The Black Is Back Coalition does not have a comprehensive strategy to resist gentrification. I know we're going to work on it, but we don't have it, and I don't know anyone who does. But I do believe that the best defense against capitalists driving us out of our communities is to confront them with a politically active and engaged community, a community that is not friendly to the exploiters and definitely not friendly to the cops whose job it is to protect the exploiters. The rebellion in Baltimore this year put a measurable dent in investments in Baltimore. Is that good news or bad news? I say it's good news. Because we know that they are not investing money in Baltimore to keep us in Baltimore. And so any lack of divestment in Baltimore probably slows down the pace of gentrification and then buys us more time to build a real movement that demands black community control of the police. Power to the people.
Herdosha Benton is straight out of Ferguson, Missouri, and a key organizer in the Uhuru movement, part of the Black Is Back Coalition.
I am the president of the International People Democratic Uhuru Movement, and I have been challenging myself to understand the world and to come into a consciousness of political life, because it's important, because I'm fighting like hell to make revolution, because I understand that's what it's going to take for my people to be free. And so in PETM, one of our campaigns right now that we are pushing for is African Shores Genocide. And so what we have been doing with African Shores Genocide is really knocking on doors, going into the neighborhoods and knocking on doors and presenting African Shores Genocide, bringing people into a conversation. A lot of people never even heard of the word genocide, and just really explaining what the word genocide is. And clearly having these conversations with little old ladies at the trap house, young kids. I even had elementary school kids, high school kids really have great questions. And clearly when I explain it to them, they see genocide in their life. They started telling me stories. Well, is this genocide? Yes. So making it a household word, and after you have a conversation like them, it makes people want to know more about the world and what it is that they face. They started saying, well, you know, you're right. Like, what do we have to do? Making them be a part of this fight. So African Shores Genocide is a very important campaign. We presented it to the United Nations. But I think the most important thing as an organizer is going to those houses and sitting down talking to these people. One thing that we had seen is because the United Nations wanted us to have an online petition. And so one struggle that we had with that is a lot of people in the neighborhoods that I was going to didn't have an email address. But they were like, I never had an email address, but I want one today. How do you set it up? And just really determine, call me, how is everything going? I have some more people in my family. When can you come over? You know, I called all my cousins. Can you come over again and sit down and explain this to them, because I want them to be a part of this? One of the things is because they understand that one of the biggest part, if white people were really concerned about stopping horizontal violence, they will understand that reparations, one of the biggest crimes ever is poverty. And that's what's happening in the hood. A lot of people say that it's, oh God, it's so bad in the hood. But it's more people like me and you that live in the hood. It's only like one or two, Pookie and Ray Ray, you know, that's just bent on trouble. But most of the hood is people like myself and yourself. And so taking it to these people and explaining the importance of organization. And then they say, you know what, you know, I've been hearing a lot of stuff about the protests and stuff, but I really appreciate what you're doing, coming here and talking to me, explaining reparations, explaining Africans Choice Genocide, explaining the word genocide to me, explaining that it's not my fault. I didn't just make bad decisions to put myself in this situation. What's happening is people like my parents that found themselves in a situation where they're homeless at 67 and 66, a retired veteran and a nurse, because they worked their whole life. But my mom can't figure out how to get off her job because what they offering her in Social Security is not enough. My aunt worked and graduated from college, and she's in a situation where she's fighting for her house because her 19-year-old son was accused of something that he did not do. That the young girl ended up saying, well, I was just mad at him, and I'm sorry, I didn't mean it. But Bob McCullough, the same month Mike Brown was killed, decided that he can prosecute him, even though the victim said that she was lying, that she was upset, and gave a 19-year-old 20 years in jail that never, ever even been pulled over to have a ticket. But he couldn't find no reason to indict Darren Wilson. This is what's going on in the world that I live in, and that's what I can speak on. And so I have to speak on another place that I'm familiar with, Ghana, Africa, that the reality of people in Africa living off barely a dollar a day, that my mother-in-law was going to, I believe she was going to church or the marketplace, and was brutally raped and beat in Ghana. And there's no hospital to take her to, that she had to lay there for days until we raised resources to send back to Ghana. Because you can't just go to the hospital and say, oh, she's bleeding, can you please help her? They was like, oh, well, nope, you got some money? Do you have the resources? So once she was actually being seen, she had an infection and everything. So then we had to raise more resources because they wouldn't give her the medicine after the doctor said what was wrong with her. And these are the realities that they live with. I have a nephew in Ghana that is school age, and he want to go to school. But it's no free schools, that his family is struggling to try to make sure that he go to school. And this is just one place in Africa. And we know Ghana is actually a place that a lot of people visit and say, oh, it's better off than most other countries in Africa. And I'm thinking to myself, like, wow, if this is better off, then what? And we know that an African go dig up a piece of gold in his own country, that's against the law. That's against the law for him to dig up something in his own country because somebody else is taking those resources and living off of them. I'm at a point where when I'm at the movement, I was heavily into a religion, and I'm not trying to bash anybody's religion, but I had to come to a point, and what I deal with being an organizer and talking to people is that African people, we all into some spirituality place, that we in a dream world, and to really bring people to a point where we have to just stay here on earth and realize that we have to fight. It's very important that, you know, when I talk to people, I'm not telling them to stop reading a Bible or reading your Quran or whatever you read. That's fine. But even in the Bible, even Jesus was a revolutionary. And, you know, you can follow him, be just like him, give your life for the people, die for the people, go make disciples, go make revolutionaries. So I think that's very important, that as an organizer, that's what I can give to this conversation, is that we as people have to look at the world right here on earth. Amen. We have everything within us to win this fight. Right, us right here. Uhuru.
That was Herdosha Benton of the Uhuru Movement at the Black is Back Coalition Conference in Washington. Bruce Dixon, the managing editor of Black Agenda Report, is glad to see that there's a whole new crop of black activists out there. The problem is, many of them can't seem to figure out how to formulate demands of power.
There have never been more black elected and appointed officials, more black corporate and military functionaries, more black faces on TV and the movies than there are right now. There's been a black family in the White House for 7 years already, and the First Lady is from the South Side of Chicago. But what does it really mean to black children in places like Chicago's South Side all around the country? The plain and simple answer for a lot of them is not a whole lot. Current census data pegs the percentage of African-American children under 6 who are growing up in poverty at 38%. That's 3 out of every 8 black children in the United States. It's been just a little higher once or twice in the several decades that particular statistic has been kept, but never by much, and never since the early 1980s. Why? Politics isn't just about voting, elections, or political parties. Politics, broadly speaking, is about how we humans arrange our collective affairs. And black politics, as far back as anyone can recall, have never been aimed at confronting those who wield power or contesting for that power. Black politics has always been about representation, about which black faces would serve best as designated spokespeople for the rest of us, which of them might best broker for our interests. Brokers don't contest power. The current waves of mass incarceration and gentrification would have been impossible without the active collaboration of large groups of black preachers, black business leaders, and black politicians, the kind of black political class which views its own glittering careers as the indisputable proof that something great is being accomplished on behalf of the oppressed. So far, the newest wave of so-called movement activists are walking down that same well-traveled road. They're asking for more representation, with themselves as the brokers this time. They want town hall meetings. They want their own presidential debates. But as Glenn Ford points out, they don't have demands. They're not proposing abolition of the crushing burden of student and consumer debt. They're not championing laws that would make the kind of mortgage fraud perpetrated by the big banks illegal, or which might let cities snatch the underwater homes from the speculators. They're not educating or organizing parents and communities to resist the wave of school privatizations or to opt out of the standardized testing which provides the fake justification for them. They're not speaking or mobilizing against the permanent warfare state which swallows fully half the nation's revenue, money which could be spent transforming cities, industries, economies, and tens of millions of lives. They're not building new political organizations that value and practice democracy internally from the bottom up, organizations that might prefigure the world we deserve. This new movement crowd has lots to say about the slippery, nebulous demons of white supremacy and institutional racism, but almost nothing against the state and corporate actors who exercise real power. Like the classes of broker leaders before them, they don't have answers to gentrification or to the housing crisis or mass incarceration. And they don't have much to say to the 3 out of every 8 black children in poverty, except to point to their own careers while declaring how much they love their blackness and that of the pretty First Lady in the White House. And yours too.
And that's it. for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.